This is Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, Senior Editor at Yes Media. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Social movements often spur participants into adopting identities that help them articulate their personal connection to a cause. Can the same happen for the movement for reparations? My next guest, Trevor Smith, asks in a new story for Yes Magazine, quote, can reparationist be a distinct identity akin to feminist or abolitionist, a label worn with pride by progressive individuals showcasing their belief in reparative compensation for Black people? Trevor Smith is co-founder and executive director of Narrative Power at the Bliss Collective, a culture change tank focused on building narrative infrastructure across Black, Indigenous, and progressive social movements to repair, decolonize, and transform culture. He was formerly the director of narrative change at Liberation Ventures, where he created and launched the Reparations Narrative Lab, a creative and research hub supporting the movement to increase public support for reparations. His story for Yes is called The Identity Politics of Reparations, and it just published as part of our new series, Realizing Reparations. Welcome to the program, Trevor.
Thanks for having me.
So let's first talk about how this came about, this idea of being a reparationist. It's not really a word that's in our dictionary yet. And you've been engaged in this world of narrative building to make reparations be an acceptable idea across the nation, be an idea that we take for granted and that we actually make happen. So how did you come up with this idea of self-identifying, people self-identifying as reparationists?
Yeah, so the term reparationist is a term that has been used for a while throughout the reparations movement. Longtime organizers throughout the movement have self-identified as reparationists. As I started to get deeper into the reparations movement, I came across more and more movement elders who use the term reparationist. Through the work that I was doing at Liberation Ventures, we launched the Reparations Narrative Lab, as you named. And one of the key goals in the first iteration of the Reparations Narrative Lab was to co-create a narrative schema, what we call the narrative house. And this schema is a tool that can be used to organize across the movement and to onboard folks into the movement in a way that aligns with the broader movement's narrative. One of the narrative areas of opportunity that we named as part of this framework, this schema, is called becoming reparationist. And it is a frame that we are trying to popularize and ideate around on what it means to be fully devoted to the repair and liberation of Black people and all oppressed people across the globe. So the term reparationist is not a new term. I've been exploring the role of social identity in movements. And I'm specifically focused on the reparations movement right now. The work that I will do with Bliss will be a little bit more broader, focused on global, decolonial, and liberatory movements. And the role of social identity is really important as we think about social movements and how we expand them and how we onboard people into them.
So how does adopting an identity on an individual level strengthen one's commitment to the cause and even maybe attract new people to a cause, if you will?
It's a great question. So that's the key of some of the research that I've been doing. This is a key question of some of the research I've been doing. I think a good example of this is in 2020. After the murder of George Floyd, we saw the popularity of How to Be an Anti-Racist become far more popular, the book by Dr. Ibram Kendi. And a part of that popularization was people also self-identifying as anti-racist. Now, I think
so anti-racist as an identity.
Exactly, anti-racist as an identity. And that, I think, is the first step. You know, I think we saw a lot of folks saying that 2020 was, quote unquote, a racial reckoning, kind of the first time we had in a while since the civil rights era really reckoned with racial injustice, police brutality. And I think depending on who you talk to, you know, there's varying levels of agreement on that. But what I think we were seeing and experiencing in that time is a rise of racial consciousness, to take words from MLK. And so that self-identification is the first step into getting deeper involved into a social movement, identifying as a anti-racist, identifying as a reparationist, an abolitionist, a feminist. Now, the second step is actually living your day-to-day lives through that praxis, through that frame of what it means to be an abolitionist and or feminist or reparationist, and have that impact your day-to-day activities, day-to-day actions. And so I think what the role of social identity in social movements is really about is having folks think about how can they live their day-to-day lives through what the values of this movement is trying to communicate.
Let's talk about those people who have been identifying as reparationists for a long time. And I love that you really bring in the elders of the movement for reparations, the folks in COBRA, the National Coalition for Blacks for Reparations in America, which has existed for a very long time. How have people involved within COBRA, really kind of embraced reparationist as an identity?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I actually start off the piece by talking to Jumoke Ifeatyo, who is a longtime member of NCOBRA, who resides in Atlanta and is key to their organizing in the South and specifically in and around Atlanta. And Jumoke talked about kind of him coming to use the term reparationist through his family, through his mother. So he talked about starting to wear traditional African clothing in the 70s when he was in middle school. He talked about really reorienting himself to the continent of Africa, and coming to that realization and thinking about kind of where he really comes from. For him was how he embraced the term reparationist. Other folks throughout the movement, elders throughout the movement have used the term reparationist. And I think for them, and I can't obviously speak for the hundreds and thousands of folks throughout the reparations movement, but I think for them, it is something that is deeply, deeply personal, right? It is something that a key part of their identity, in the same way that for me, being a son, a brother, a soccer player, a writer is a key part of my identity, and that really shapes who I am and how I show up in the world. It's the same thing as it relates to folks in the reparations movement. For so long, dedicated organizers have been calling for reparations, making the moral arguments for reparations, making the political, cultural, economic arguments for reparations, and it has been a key part of their activism. And so the term reparationist, I think, has long held a lot of deep spiritual values. When you say it, these days, someone knows that you have a deep commitment to an issue that has long been seen as taboo. Now, I think the goal is to popularize that term, but not just popularize the term, popularize the values that come along with what it means to be a reparationist and really have folks live through those values. And that is what I think the organizers who have, long called themselves reparationists, the elders of the past who showed up in the abolitionist movement, these were the, modern day reparationists, I think, hold the same values of those who fought for the abolition of slavery, those like Frederick Douglass, the abolitionists of those times. And it's not only about the term, right? It's fighting for a cause. And that's what I really think the term means.
Right. I mean, and then there's also a modern day abolitionist movement around the abolition of the prison industrial complex and of policing. And so speaking of that, there are these multiple overlapping identities we all hold, right? Like many of us maybe identify as feminist, but some of us identify as feminists of color. As you point out in your story, there are, Black women identify as Black feminists as an identity very distinct from what has been the sort of default feminism, but really what is white feminism, not always identified that way. And you cite Kimberlé Crenshaw's work, Dr. Kimberlé Crenshaw, and her formation of this intersectionality, that many of us sit at these intersections of overlapping identities. And in that framework, can reparationist work seamlessly with other progressive facing identities?
I definitely think so. And one of the really interesting things that I found when doing this reporting for this piece was speaking to folks who don't primarily self-identify as reparationists, folks like Vanessa Thompson, who, as you said, identifies mostly as a Black feminist, or folks like Richie Recita, who most prominently identifies as an abolitionist. What I found when speaking to these folks, to Vanessa and Richie and others who I interviewed for the piece, is that their vision for the future, their vision for the world that we want to live in, is very similar to those who primarily self-identify as reparationists. I think the key difference is just what they are focused on in the moment. So folks who are focused on reparations are calling for, reparations policy at the local, state, and federal level for Black people in the United States. Folks like Richie, folks who are focused on abolition or who claim the abolitionist identity, are mostly situated within kind of the criminal justice movement, calling for the defunding of the police, or calling for the ending of cash bail, or calling for the legalization of drugs like marijuana, or the repair for the war on drugs. And so, even though we might be focused day to day on different types of policy areas, different types of what I like to call policy movement areas, our goal and our vision for the future is the same. So now, and this is where I think the role of narrative infrastructure is really important, the narrative and movement structure is really important. We need to tie these movements closer together. And there's a lot of work, I think, to de-silo the justice movement. I think you look across philanthropy, you'll see that one portfolio is focused on economic justice, another portfolio is focused on climate justice. You have one portfolio focused on racial justice. I understand the need to do that as it relates to kind of focusing on strategy and year to year goals and year to year priorities, but the goal, the goal, the end goal here, I think what we're all fighting for is repair, abolition, and liberation. And so these things won't happen if we're in silos. And that's kind of one of the things that we're thinking about at BLIS. And BLIS stands for Black Liberation Indigenous Sovereignty. How can we build an organization that's focused on exploring the repair for both Black communities and Indigenous communities, while also knowing that we need a broad base of people and we need to think about the role of class in the specific redress for specific communities? So I say all that to say that it is possible. I think what is needed to accomplish this is more robust narrative infrastructure so that organizers and organizations across the country are forwarding similar narratives around liberation, decolonization, and abolition to make it easier for folks to onboard into these liberatory social identities. And then, two, the research that is needed to track what makes someone want to identify as a reparationist, what makes someone want to identify as an abolitionist. Pop Culture Collaborative, which I cite in the piece as well, they talk a lot about kind of these inciting incidents. And so, in speaking with Jamoke, his inciting incident was really coming to that realization when he was a young kid around his origin story, around his roots from Africa. For every person, it'll be different. I talked to Lottie Leib Dula, who's a white person who now claims the term, who claims the identity reparationist. And for her, it was after the death of her mother and sorting through different artifacts and seeing what her family's role was in anti-Blackness in the United States. And that was her inciting incident. And so we need to kind of do a little bit more exploration on what are the different types of inciting incidents that can make people not only self-identify as these liberatory social identities, but then live their life through them. And that's what happened with Lottie. That's what happened with Jamoke. And that, I think, is really a lot of the work that we're trying to do in the modern day movement for liberation. And I think the other thing that I will say, and that I cite in the piece as well, is that, obviously there is drawbacks to organizing around identity. Olufemi Taiwo has, written about some of the kind of toxic nature or the opportunities for identity politics to be captured. And we've seen that right now. And we're seeing that right now from kind of nefarious actors who are kind of muddling up what it means to kind of participate in DEI activities, what it means to teach a class on critical race theory. And so there are kind of drawbacks around identity politics as well that we have to also, think about. But I think the key question that we should hold at the center is, how can we effectively integrate diverse social identities into a cohesive global movement for liberation.
So you brought up Lotte Lieb, who I think is fascinating, because when we talk about intersecting identities, she is a white reparationist, and generally this movement for reparations has been seen as a movement that is restricted to Black Americans. Certainly, it's led by Black Americans, but it's an issue that really needs to have buy-in from the entire country as a whole. Whole, right? Because that's how we move forward and ensure that we never engage in the kind of racial harms that require reparations. So tell me Lottie's story and how non-Black Americans can adopt an identity of being reparationist.
Yeah, so Lottie is a very interesting person. I met her a couple of years ago. She's based in Colorado, and she's one of the founders of Reparations for Slavery, which is an information hub that can be found online, reparationsforslavery.com. And her focus is really onboarding white people and white wealth holders, particularly into the reparations movement, to see themselves as reparationists in the same way that she did. And so her journey really began after her mother passed. As I said earlier, she uncovered some artifacts where she found out that the wealth of her family was built on enslavement. And she realized that her mom had kept this history from her, along with the history that her mom or that a part of her family were members of the United Daughters for Confederacy, which has played a huge role in kind of whitewashing the history of the Civil War and really shining the Confederacy in a different light. And so that was her inciting incident. And that kind of has made her committed to, in her words, unwhitewashing this history and encouraging other white people to find their own piece to the puzzle and speak publicly about reparations. And so that's Lottie's story. And I think that white people definitely have a role to play in reparations, in racial justice writ large. I think I was just having this conversation with my team yesterday. There's various questions that we need to ask ourselves, both as Black organizers and as white organizers. How can we make our movements welcoming to everybody, right? And what is the work that non-Black communities, white people need to do to see themselves in specific movements like reparations and vice versa? One of the things I'm exploring at Bliss right now is what is my role as a Black person in the movement for Indigenous sovereignty, in the movement for Indigenous repair, Indigenous liberation? What is the work that I have to do as a Black person to show up as a better ally for Indigenous people whose land were stolen? And so we all can show up as leaders, and we all must show up as allies. One of the things that I've been also exploring recently is just the frame and thinking around inheritance. We all inherit something. Some of us inherit privilege, some of us inherit hardships, but we all inherit a history of harm. And so I think it is our responsibility then to collectively repair this history of harm. And we all will show up in different ways in that repair. Some of us who inherit privilege need to show up in different ways than some of us who inherit these hardships, but we all must be a part of the movement for reparations. And one of the things that is really important in addressing this and growing the movement for reparations is what I call the hope gap, which I've written about in Yes Magazine before. And so the hope gap specifically is a term that I coined on the gap between support for reparations in the Black community and belief that it'll happen. So support for reparations in the Black community kind of hovers around the high 70 percentile, but belief that it'll happen is less than 10%. So that gap between support and belief is what I call the hope gap. And it's important to address this hope gap, to make Black folks believe that reparations is possible. And then doing that, we can inspire action through others. I think Lottie is a very great case, is a very interesting story, but I'm not quite sure that every white person across the United States, especially if they don't have a unique history in the way that Lottie does, will go through that same sort of transformation. What we need to do is make our movements irresistible, right? And I think the way in
Right.
which we do that is by building a large and beautiful Black-led movement that also speaks to the other movements that are seeking to address oppression, that are seeking to address historical injustices. And that's exactly why we're starting Bliss. We think that if we're able to kind of fortify Black and Indigenous movements, Black and Indigenous communities That is how, and really have folks really understand the history of colonization in this country. That is a major step that is going to be needed in order to have a multiracial, and working class, filled movement for repair, for liberation, for prosperity.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Trevor, as always, for joining us. We'll post a link to your story from our website and always appreciate having you on. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
My guest has been Trevor Smith. He's the co-founder and executive director of Narrative Power at the Bliss Collective. We've been discussing his latest story for Yes magazine called The Identity Politics of Reparations. It's just published as part of our new series, Realizing Reparations. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, senior editor at Yes Media and host of Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Our audio podcast is on iTunes and Spotify.